Bhutam bhavishyat cha bhavat swakale. Bhutam bhavishyat cha bhavat swakale. Tadvartamanasya vihaya tattvam. Tadvartamanasya vihaya tattvam. Hasyanakim syat gatabha vicharcha. Hasyanakim syat gatabha vicharcha. Vinayaka sankhyam gananeva loke. Vinayaka sankhyam gananeva loke. Bhutam bhavishyat cha bhavat swakale tad vartamanasya vihaya tattvam hasya na kim syat gata bhavi charcha vina eka sankhyam ganana eva loke. Sandhi. Okay. So Ramana says, Bhutam, the past, Bhavishyat cha, the past and the future. Bhutam is the past, Bhavishyat is the future. So both the past, cha means end. Bhutam, Bhavishyat cha, both the past and the future. Bhavat svakale, in their own time, swa means own, svakale, kale is time. So call it in their own time are bhavat, the present. Both the past and the future are in their own time when they're happening, the present. Okay. Tad vartamanasya vihaya tattvam. Vihaya. Giving up, for Sanskrit people, giving up indeclinable past participle. Abandoning. Giving up the tattvam, the truth of their future, of their present, of that present, the present that is there at during their own time, when the past is there, that's the present, right? When the future is there, that's the present. So giving up the tattva, the reality, the truth of that present, then he says, hasyat na kim syat gatabha vicharcha. Having given up the truth of the present in the inquiring of that, he says, a charcha, a discussion, charcha means it like a discussion, an inquiry, into the gata, that which is gone, the past, and bhavi, that which will come. So any charcha, any type of discussion or inquiry into the past and the future, nakim syat, Asya, is that not laughable? Isn't that laughable? A discussion, isn't a charcha a discussion about the past or the future? Hasya, laughable. Isn't it laughable? If you've given up the present that is the truth of the past and the future. Because when the past and the future are occurring, that is only put on the present. So isn't it laughable to give up? Isn't any discussion on the past and the future laughable? You know, having given up the truth of that present. And then he gives an example. Vina ekasankhyam. He says, ganana eva loke. Like, eva means like, in the world. Ganana, counting, without the number one. Vina means without. Eka is one. Sankhyam is number. So the, without the eka sankhyam, without the number one, counting, how can there be counting in the world, like in the world, trying to count without the number one? Right? Because every number that you're adding together is one. Right? One plus one plus one plus one can become, say, eventually becomes five. Plus one plus one plus one plus four, we say five plus four. But what is this one plus one plus one plus one plus one? That's what it is. So if you get rid of the number one, you know, if you get rid of the number one, how can there even be counting? So the inquiry really has to be into the truth, the true nature of the present, right? The true nature of the present, which is there as the very self, the very truth of the past and the future. Everybody see the verse? Understand the verse? All right, let's move on then. Okay.
You're kidding, right?
Yes. Even an inquiry into what we call the present in terms of my experience of the world, like for instance, I could say, right now, this is the present. Right? This is the present. What happened an hour ago is the past. What will happen an hour from now is the future. You know, so we're kind of shrinking it. Usually we think the past, so that's happened yesterday or last week or last year. The future is what we project into the future. And so we have some kind of expansive time, you know, in terms of the past. And this present is actually a big piece. This is the present. The present for us could last all day. The present could last for this minute. But then that's the problem. Where do we stop in our delineation of the present? In other words, we can say, this moment is the present. Okay? This moment is the present. But as soon as I said the word this, the present of this is already gone. As soon as, I said, that's gone. And so, in fact, when we start analyzing the nature of the present in reference to our experience, the present is actually something that we can never find. And this is the reason. When we say, just conceptually, when we say past, present, and future, we're talking about a linear flow of time, you know, an experience. First this came, then this came, then this came, then this came, then this came. Okay? When we say first this came, then how big is this first? How much space, how much time does it take up, you know? So, in fact, I had one of my colleagues and also a student of Swamiji from many, many years ago, actually was a scientist who was a professor up at Humboldt State. And he did a study on the nature of time, the past, present, and future. What is time? Where can we find the present? And he used some sophisticated equipment where he was able to take snapshots, you know, small snapshots of moments, of the smallest moment that his machines were able to capture, the smallest moments. And those moments he was able to graph and divide. He was able to graph the time that particular moment took, and it had a little wiggly on it. And so what he was trying to show that even when you got to the smallest moment, which would be the present, your smallest moment is the present, that moment was divisible. That's what he was doing with all of his measurements and his scientific equipment. In India, with the experiment, what they do to try to make this clear, this problem, is that in India, you know, whenever we do the pujas, often or the pujas at the temple, oftentimes we use rose petals, and sometimes, you know, before the puja, we'll actually be pulling off the petals one by one by one. And so Swamiji uses this example that you could take those petals and put them together, because they're so delicate and they're so thin. You could say maybe take 500 petals and put them together and they take up maybe this much space. Because they're so fine and they're so thin. Now you have these 500 petals, and you can take a needle, because you can also make malas with these petals. You can take a needle and you can put the needle through the petals in the smallest instant, because no resistance. The needle just goes immediately through the petal. And so you can say, how long did it take that needle to go through those 500 petals? It's such a small amount of time. It's less than the click of a finger. But then the needle had to go through each petal one at a time. Right? Each petal one at a time. So in that instant that the needle passes through all the petals, that instant has to be divided into 500 moments. And so each moment is the present. Right? Each moment is the present. So in the moment now, we have 500 presents. See what I mean? So, now what's interesting also about this is that the present is that point between the past, which is gone, and the future, which is yet to come. The past is no longer here. So even your memory, say if you can remember your past, you can remember the last moment, but that memory is also taking place in the present. You can project the future, think about the future, contemplate on the future, but the future also is taking place in the present. The future thoughts, they're just thoughts that are taking place in the present. And so now, if you think about it, this is what the Upanishad will say, is something that will crack your mind, will blow your mind. They actually say that. With how they say it, it'll blow your head apart if you think about this. You're in any present moment, that is, the past is no longer there and the future hasn't yet come. Right? So now, here we are in this moment, past is gone, future hasn't come. The problem is that the moment that we choose is infinitely divisible, because time is linear. And so past, present, future, as long as you can divide the present, the past is gone, the future hasn't yet come. Now the problem is, since time takes up, is linear, you can always divide it. Right? You can always divide it. There's no end. That's kind of like an infinite regress. There's no end to that division as long as it takes up time. And so the moment is impossible to find in the creation. And yet, we are always in the present. Right? Because when the past is there, that is your present. When the present is there, that you can't find, right? That is the present. When the future is there, that is the present. But the present is not something that can be found in the creation. So Swamiji has a way of saying this that I've always loved, and he's done it for how many years? Many. It's the present actually, the truth of the present is actually your presence. Your presence. The presence of the self, the presence of your own being, which illumines time. Your presence is the presence in which the infinitely divisible flow of time takes place. That's why it's not any problem for you. You never feel that there's no present, because in fact, all that is here is the presence, which is the truth of the so-called present in the creation, which is not something that you even have any possibility of discovering whatsoever. But non-problematic, because everything takes place in the presence of yourself, and the presence of yourself is timeless. So how can the presence of yourself be timeless? In fact, that is your experience. You do experience the presence of yourself as timeless. But the problem is, we don't think about that. And we can't really think about that, because I identify my own presence with my body and with my mind and my body, my mind, my sense organs, all of my experiences receive my presence. It's as though my mind gives my presence to these changing experiences. And as I give my presence to these changing experiences, the changing experiences become as though stable. Because even though they're coming and going, all my whole life is coming and going, coming and going, coming and going, all of this coming and going, all of this change is taking place in a self that is not coming and going. And so I feel fine with the disappearance of everything. It's literally what it is. So just think about it. At this moment, it's gone. Whatever was in the last moment, you know, isn't not here anymore. The future is not here. And so where do you divide the line to say this doesn't exist? The past is gone. It doesn't exist. The future hasn't come. It doesn't exist. Don't you think that would be a problem? You know? because you can't even find the moment is infinitely divisible. And so how could we even have any sense of being at all? You know? How can we have any sense of being when the non-existence of the past and the non-existence of the future way outweighs, you know, the present that we're not able to find because of being infinitely divisible? So how could we even have any experience of, at all, actually? Yeah. And so here, what do we have to do? What has to happen here is that you have to start from this creation. This is what Ramana is doing in this. You have to start from your experience in this creation, you know? And he says, you know, something that we can all understand and all nod our heads to is that when the past is occurring, that is the present. Right? When the past was there, that was the present. You can say, yes, that's, of course that's true. When the future might be there, that is the present. That, of course, is true. What I'm experiencing right now, whatever it may be, that is the present. And so now the question has to be, what is that present? What is that present that we take for granted when, in fact, the flow of time is continually and infinitely negating it? Does everybody see that? The flow of time, moment by moment by moment, negates the present. And the present is continually being swept away. The present becomes the past, right? The present continually becomes the past to the point that we can't find that moment of present. The present is continually becoming the past, and then the future is becoming the present. See that? It's a continual flow of time. But I'm always present to that continual flow of time. And so that would make me think, well, who is it that is present to the flow of time? In fact, I am aware of time. What does that mean? If I say I am aware of time, it means, you know, I am aware of change. Time and change go together. If you stop change, there is no time. What if everything were to freeze and just stop? Then there is no time. There's just an eternal present, an eternal present. Because no motion, no movement at all. And so time and change go together. What is my relationship to change? And we ask, well, can the one who is aware of change be changing? Right? Can I, who am aware of change, be changing? Let me show you the problem with that. If you say, yes, of course I can be changing. Well, if you can be changing, the one who is changed is no longer here. Right? What is changed is no longer here. And so if that was me, that me is gone. Do you see that? Let me give you a kind of an example that takes a little, it's a little step away, but it still works. If I have my clay pot, my good old clay pot, the clay pot, the pot, right, is here until I change it into a plate. It's a wet lump of clay. It's been made into a pot. Now the pot is here until I change it into a plate. Right? Now from the standpoint of the plate, there is no pot. It doesn't exist anymore. And so what if the pot was the self? That self is gone, right? And now the plate self has come. And now say I make it into a tumbler, now the tumbler self has come. Really, tumbler, plate, and pot have nothing in common. You know? Your mind will say, oh yes they do, they're all clay. Well, that's absolutely true. That is the constant. So, I can say from the standpoint of the clay, there is no problem. I am the presence. I am the reality of all three. But if the pot has to maintain itself once the plate has come, then we're really in trouble. So now, because it's not here anymore. So now look at it in terms of this creation. Look at your situation here. There's nothing in your experience, say just in your sensory perception, your sense perception. There's nothing here that is not changing. In fact, you can't find a moment here, you know, because every moment is infinitely divisible. There's no constant here. It's continually changing, and so all of the names and forms that you're experiencing are gone as you experience them. They're gone as you experience them because of the nature of change. That's what I was saying. My colleague was unable, with all of his equipment, to find an ultimate moment. That's what he was trying to find. He couldn't find an ultimate moment. Every moment, with all of this fancy machinery that he had, was divisible into further moments, and he could graph. He took this to Swamiji. It was a big, it was like a big binder full of all of these snapshots of moments that got down to the smallest degree. They have very interesting names for all of these micro moments. Micro moments within micro moments within micro moments still had a moving graph. So this is what he took to show Swamiji. So here in this world, in this your world of sensory experience, this is your situation. Every moment is divisible into future moments. And so everything that you experience, your mind isn't even fast enough to experience, to capture a moment, because it's gone in terms of a micro moment. Micro, micro, micro moment. Physical body, same situation. It's physical body also. You know, it's not just through sense perception of anything external to the physical body. The physical body also, as we know, is in continual flux, continual change, down to the point of micro moments. And that means that every time a micro moment, we've moved into the next micro moment, which itself is infinitely divisible, the past is gone. It's like the pot has gone, the plate has come, you know? And so that's true for all of your experience. The pot has gone, the plate has come. The pot has no relationship to the plate. And so if your being or any part of your being has anything to do with something which by its nature is subject to change, it's gone before you can even cognize that it's gone. And so that basically means that you are not here. You are not here to have any relationship to the past moment. See what I mean? It's the same with your mind. All of the thoughts in your mind, your sense organs are something, let's go to the sense organs first, the sense organs, your eyes and your ears, you know, your sense of touch, all of the sense organs also are functioning. They're instruments of which you use. You use your eyes, you use your ears, you're aware of them. You're aware of if they're working. They're something which you know and that you experience. Your sense organs themselves as instruments you experience. You illumine them. They are also just as on a cellular and micro, on cellular and molecular level, they're continually changing, along with all the perceptions that they're giving you, continually changing. Your mind also, continually changing. You can't stop it from changing. You know, that's the problem for people who'd like to just have, a stable, calm, quiet mind. But then if I ask you, do you really want your mind to be changeless? Well, that would be a huge problem too. Now, we don't just want it to be changeless. We want to be calm and to be peaceful and to, you know, have a certain sense of fullness and ananda, you know. And let's just stop it there. Let's have the ananda flow. But we, you know, the flow of fullness. But that's not possible either. The mind is very engaged, and you can't tell your mind. So interesting. You can't tell your mind to only have this thought or that thought. Right? That would be something, wouldn't it? Oh, mind, listen. These are the type of emotions I would like you to have. These are the type of experiences and perceptions. This is how I would really like you to interpret your experience. Interpret your experience in a way that helps you to maintain your shanti. It's not possible. The mind is also taking in incredible amounts of data all of the time, which you simply, as long as you have open sense organs, you can't control the flow of data that is coming in through the sense organs. In fact, they've done studies that what the mind can actually cognize compared to the flow of data that's actually coming through is minuscule. And all of that is just dumping into your unconscious, filling it up and filling it up like you have a vast ocean of unconscious, you know, and just so much that you're able to take in. But the mind is taking on more and more and more and more and more. And what if it was the pot plate? We're much more identified with our mind, but if it's the, you know, the pot plate tumbler, this vritti means thought. This thought, this thought, this thought, this thought. Every thought that goes, you're gone. It's not so. You know, we usually don't analyze it like this. But it's important that we do analyze it, because once we start recognizing the problem here in terms of time and change, we have to keep going deeper and deeper and deeper into our experience to get to the one who is ultimately, right, ultimately the one who is present to change. You must be the one who is present to change. Otherwise, you are not. You're gone already. If you are look at the problem here. If you are the one who is present to change, the one who illumines change, the one who is the presence of change, the presence, the one who is present to change. So the presence, I could say this language, the one who is the presence in which change takes place, then what is your nature? Right? If you are part of the world of change, you're gone. There is no self-experience, really. But now, if you are the one who is present to the change of the mind, the change of the sense organs, the change of the emotions, the change of the physical body, the change of the world, if you are ultimately the one who is present to change, who illumines change, then what is your nature?
Changeless.
Changeless. If it's not changeless, you're already not here. Right? But look at your experience now. I am the one who is always present. You know, so if I could use language. I am the one who is present to change. Like, for instance, just take your thought. Thoughts are constant. We always talk about thought flow. One thought after another thought after another thought after another thought. That's natural for the mind. In all different types of meditations in the East, and probably the from Western spiritual disciplines also, any type of meditative practice, one thing that we always do is just let ourselves relax and let ourselves become aware of thought flow. And what do you recognize when you become aware of thought after thought after thought? You can discriminate your experience to the recognition that any thought you have, you know, rises, comes into being, is illumined, and it goes out of being. Right? It comes, is known, and it goes. It comes, is known, and it goes. You are present to receive it. It comes, you say like this. Every thought, it comes into my awareness. As it comes into my awareness, it is known. When it goes, it's gone. I'm still here. I don't arrive with the thought and leave when it goes. Right? That doesn't make any sense. I am the self. I am the conscious being into which all of these thoughts rise and set. All emotions rise and set. All experiences rise and set. And so that being, in a sense, very obvious when we say it, but the implications of it are very profound. You have to say, yes, I'm here before, during, and after the thought. You're not going to say that I just arrived with the thought and I left when it went. You're not going to say that, you know. But the implications are very important. It means that there is something here in my experience which needs to be discerned. And that is that my own presence, the me, the self, who has all these thoughts, if I use language like that, the self who has these thoughts is not only free of the thoughts, but also not modifying, not subject to change. The change is not subject to the coming and going of the changing thoughts. To start there. I am not subject to the change, to the coming and going of the changing thoughts. That means a viveka, a discrimination I have to do here. Because what this means, if I understand it, is that it doesn't matter what the changing thoughts are, whether they be good thoughts or bad thoughts or painful thoughts or beautiful thoughts or ugly thoughts or angry thoughts or, you know, kind and compassionate thoughts or perceptions or memories. It doesn't matter what the thoughts are. I am present to the thoughts. I am the conscious being that is stable and present to the thoughts, and also which can be differentiated from the thoughts. In other words, a changeless self, which is me, is there, present and pervasive too, as the very conscious being in which all the thoughts takes place. But I am present to the thoughts, the consciousness which the thoughts enjoy, and I am completely free of the thoughts. Now I can say, I am present to my emotions. I am the conscious being in which the emotions rise and set. And I am completely free of my emotions. What does this mean then? That there is a me, you know, myself is someone who is pervasive to my experiences, because no experience is away of awareness, away from my awareness, from consciousness. Or how would I know it? Right? If any experience you have is away from consciousness, it's not your experience. You don't have it. But the experience, so the conscious being that you are is pervasive to your experience, whatever these changing experiences, but it itself is not touched by them. And so now the question is, this has such huge repercussions. What is my nature, this conscious being? Is my being, as I am, acceptable to me? Is consciousness something that I want to be? I say, oh no. Don't tell me. Don't tell me I'm that. You know? Don't tell me that I'm a changeless consciousness. And so I say, why shouldn't I tell you that? Well, I don't know what that is. I don't know what it would be to be that changeless consciousness. Yes, you do know. Yes, you do know, because the one who is present to all experiences is you. You are the one who is changelessly there, present to every experience that you have. You are the one who is not flowing in time. You are the one in whom time takes place, right? Every experience you have is your experience, right? It's not somebody else's experience. And so experience, me. Right? Mm-hmm. I am the self of all experience. And the self, the one who does not go away, does not flow, that is me. And what am I like? This conscious being. So then we have to think about that. What is that good enough? You know, am I this conscious being desirable by my nature? Do I have a desirable nature? Do I have a nature which is loved? Do I have a loved nature? Or do I have a hated nature? Or am I like space? Wouldn't that be awful? You're a conscious being, neutral like space. But that isn't the truth. So let's just look at some experiences. One of the experiences that sometimes Swamiji goes on and on about, that actually was very meaningful to me when I first started to understand it. He'll go like this. Just think of your bed. What does your bed look like? Is it a comfortable mattress? What type of sheets do you use? Do you have a comforter? No? What do you do when you crawl into bed? You know, when you kind of get yourself into that very comfortable position and you have your pillows and pull the comforter up around you. And then just think about what you're preparing to do when you go to bed. You are preparing to blot out the entire world. And you're blotting out the entire world. You're shutting down your sense organs. So you prepare for this. Most of us have just a wonderful bed, you know, so that we can be very comfy. So you're preparing now to blot out the world of experience. The one. Then you're also just the physical world. We're going to blot that out now. Oh, thank goodness. Okay. We're going to blot that out. And then we're blotting out our sense perception. And then we're totally going to shut down our mind. We're going to shut down our mind so our mind isn't even thinking. It's going to just go into deep sleep. You know, not only that, we're even going to shut down the one who has a running commentary on the nature of my experience. There's not even deep sleep. There's not even anybody there saying, oh, look, I'm deep sleeping. Isn't that wonderful? That one's gone too. The whole samsara, the whole world of duality, right? We are happily shutting down without even wanting a commentary or even an I thought. They're validating the whole thing. We don't even want that. What are we doing? We're just simply being me. Everything that can be eliminated is eliminated. Temporarily, you know, but it is shut down from my experience so that I can just be me. And so then I enjoy that, you know. I enjoy it, and then in the morning, the alarm goes off. And it pulls me out, and often I put on the snooze. Now, let me just have a few more minutes. And then the thing is, our mind is pulled out to a semi-waking state, and what do we want to do is just enjoy sleeping, seeping back in to my being. To who else? Sleep seeping back into my being. Let me just be there for a while. Because why? Ananda. Because ananda. Because of fullness. Because of unmitigated, uninterrupted, you know, wholeness. So I sit there and then eventually I get up. Number one. What do we do in meditation? Why do people meditate? Just think about what you're doing in meditation. Okay. I sit and I relax my body. I get into a quiet space. I sit. I relax my body. Why? Because I don't want to feel it. Really? I relax my body so that nothing is pulling at me, no aches and pains. So the body, as though in the deep relaxation, you know, it just disappears into space. Right? And the environment is quiet, and so I relax my body, it disappears into space. And then I can bring in a mantra to do some japa to help me to do what? Totally quieten my mind so that it's not thinking. Then when I do some pranayama, to absorb the mind even more. And then what do? I just allow myself to focus or to relax into my own presence, having turned my mind away from the world of duality, just so that I can sit with myself. Okay? Now, do we do that because it's a horrible experience? Or because it's so refreshing? It's such a relief. There's no obstructions. There's no worldly obstructions or the obstructions of duality, the likes and dislikes and all of these type of things that go on in duality to as though interrupt, you know, the very my own nature, to as though compete with my own nature. Well, that's meditation, you know. That's what we do. You know? Deep sleep is the lazy man's meditation, right? Because even though there's a great I don't know ignorance there, you have nicely blotted out everything so that you can just be that one who is changeless, that one who is free of time, that one who's simply is. Now the nature of that isness is what I'm talking about. So it's why we call in the Upanishads it's Satchit Ananda. That means that your being, your amness, the being that you are, right, is consciousness, not consciousness of anything. It's just self-evident me-ness, being, which is absolutely whole and full and complete. If we could recognize my being, this being that I sometimes have to try to blot out the world so that I can just be with myself in an uninterrupted way. What if, in reference to all of the sensations that are passing through this thought, this thought, this thought, that I am aware of my own presence, the own presence in which all of these thoughts are taking place, in which all of these experiences are taking place, and my mind is not lost. My mind gets lost out here, you know, in all of these names and forms, which in fact are not away and not separate from my presence, but my mind gets lost in them, and then my mind will start saying, it's like saying, you know, I want this presence. I want my presence in this form, you know, and this person is stopping me from getting my presence in this form. You see what I mean? And I need this complex situation. I need to create this situation so that my presence can be in that form. In that form, my presence, the presence and the form get all intertangled with each other, where in fact your presence, which is filling the every form, every vritti, every experience, that presence is never away from any form. It's never away from any thought. And so knowledge, self-knowledge, or moksha, liberation, all of these things, what's such a simple thing, really, it has to do with your recognition of that wholeness of your being that is never apart from any experience at all, but is also never touched or changed by it. And once you recognize that that ananda, that your own presence is, in fact, what your mind is seeking out here, once it realizes that, then the mind settles down, because why do I want my presence in that form when actually it's the self of every form? What happens is the mind gets lost in the waves of the ocean, you know, it gets lost in the waves of names and forms, and then it can't control those names and forms, because names and forms are by their nature continually changing and continually impacted by other names and forms. And so this name and form, with a sensory name and form, with a mind that is continually changing, is trying to capture presence or being, my very being, in the name, in terms of the names and forms which by their nature are coming and going. You know? And so you have coming and going, the coming and going body, mind, sense organs trying to capture the coming and going experiences. And it's not going to work. It never does work. It never has worked. What has worked at any time? What has worked is that you have had moments where this changing phenomena lines up in such a way that your mind feels happy, because I want that particular form. I want that particular form. Now, sometimes when you actually want, you have a mind that wants a particular form, at sometimes you are wanting it and you're getting it line up. Like, I want this form and I get this form. See that? I want the form and I get the form. You could want the form and want the form and want the form, but by the time you get it, you don't want it anymore. So everything has to line up. But now, say you want this particular form. Form stands for any situation. I want this form and I get it. What that means is at that very moment, your mind is free of desire. I desire this form, I get it. My mind now is absolutely peaceful. For how long? Just seconds. It's so awful. You fulfill your desire. You fulfill the desire in this whirlwind of change. And you get that moment where everything is perfect and you feel a great ananda because no obstruction. Your desires are fulfilled. There's no obstructions. You're so happy. But then, of course, it changes, and it changes in a variety of ways. Either some other form can come in and interact and bump it out of the way, you know, or what happens so often is that your desire is fulfilled and that fulfillment lasts for 30 seconds, or how long, before another desire comes. And then I can remember myself feeling shocked. It only took this long for the next desire to come. I could only have that amount of rest before the next desire or worry would come. Right? Because we've totally superimposed my changeless presence, that wholeness, onto these objects in the world. You know, it's like imposing the clay onto the pot. That's quite an imposition. You impose the clay onto the pot, and then you have to have the pot. You don't want the plate. You don't want the tumbler. There's a big war between the plate and the tumbler and the pot, and who wants what? When actually there's only clay there. Now, what if you're an enlightened pot? What if you know that you're clay? You know? Then does it matter to you whether it's, you know, clay pot or clay tumbler or clay plate when the only thing that's there is clay? So what if I see here in all of my experience me? It is me. Nothingness, it is me. I'm the self of the whole thing. And at the same time, you know, I'm not changing. This is what we mean for some of you. Satyam Mitya. You know, myself, I'm the very changeless being of all of these experiences. And when my mind recognizes it, the devotion or the commitment to the mind is to its home. What does that mean? It means that for my mind, then out of the fullness, the changeless being that I am, I experience the world. I experience my relationship with you, you know. I experience my job, I experience my emotions, I experience everything. But from that vantage point of a changeless whole self. Now once that's understood, then all of the thoughts and the emotions and the likes and dislikes and just all of the complexity of samsara, it comes with crashing through. You know, it's not like you gain knowledge and samsara stops. Mm. Or you gain knowledge and the world stops. No. You gain knowledge and it keeps going on in its tumultuous way. But there's somebody there who's not tumultuous. You are a self that the whole mind, body, sense organ world can rely on and trust. You cannot rely on and trust the world. It's not the world's fault. It's the world's nature. Because, oh, look at how the world is. Yes, that is exactly how it is. It's continual birth and death. It's continual change. There's not a constant here. From the standpoint of the waves of the ocean, there's not a constant. But there very much is a constant. And that constant is the very self which illumines the whole thing. I have to recognize that. Now, next week we'll go into the next verse that takes it a little further, but just a couple of things I want you to see. The self that I am, which is timeless, itself can't be an object in the creation. There's no timeless, nothing timeless in the creation. It doesn't exist. And so I can't take myself and look at it as an object in the creation. I can't do that. You can't do that. Nobody can do that. And so this timeless self is non-objectifiable. It is the bottom line subject. But that being so, even say when I illumine a thought modification, I illumine the entire thought modification. What if I have a thought modification of this room that I'm looking at through my eyes? I, the conscious being, am present to the whole room. That thought modification. And the same for you. But when we start looking at my own being, that this being that is the bottom line that can't be objectified and be an object in the world, nor can you be an object in the world, nor can you be an object in the world, the consciousness, then what is my relationship of my being to your being? Like my relationship, this body, because this body exists within time and space, it exists within duality, and I'm different from you, and I look like this, and you look like that. I'm sitting here, you're sitting there. But me, the conscious being, what is my conscious, the conscious being that I am, how does it relate to the conscious being that you are? I'm not an object in the world, and neither are you. So what is dividing us? For there to be two conscious beings. Space, even space is illumined. Time is illumined. Anything objectified, all this exists within duality, and we can have separation, and you're different than me. It's all true. My thoughts are different than your thoughts. You know, I'm different than the chair. But from the standpoint of your being, you know, which is changeless, which is the one in whom all change takes place, where is there a distinction between us? That's why Ramana will say in the next verse, this time and space and distinction, that always is from the standpoint of the body, not from the standpoint of you. From the standpoint of you, there's only one me. And that me is you. Right? When you say, I am, I exist, your mind is pointing to your own presence. So say all of us in the room, we all have minds, and each one of us says, I am, I exist. That's the mind, which is illumined, is commenting on my nature. So now I say I am, and you say I am, and you say I am. Does that mean that there's 20 I ams in the room? Or are there 20 minds that are acknowledging that silent, non-objectifiable presence that is me? So this is the next level of understanding that we have to have, and it's with that level of understanding that we can understand Ishvara, or what we mean by God. Because in the end, how can I be different from you? And if I'm not different from you, then from the standpoint of my own being, then there's only one. And that one is the one that illumines the creation. That's what we call Ishvara. So I'm slowly going there in terms of this book. But let's stop here for the night, okay? Let's just take a moment. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Is it natural to the mind, once it recognizes that the well-being is my own consciousness, is it still natural for the mind to continue looking for wellness in the creation?
For a while, because there's kind of an emotional, I call it an emotional lag time, and the habits of the mind that, you know, I need this to be happy. The mind is so ingrained with that life beginningness that it takes some time for the mind to really, all the different levels and aspects of the mind to assimilate this knowledge, until I think as you mature in the knowledge, it just, we can be very, very engaged in the world and enjoy it, but it's not worth getting upset over. That's what it amounts to. It's like I'm not willing to give up my shanti because I want this. Because, you know, it's like wanting the giraffe graham cracker instead of the horse graham cracker. It's just simply, it's not worth it. It's better just to, you find, as I'm just saying, that you find over time that it's just better to be present to your life and objectively do the very best you can and be engaged in it. You know, but you start seeing it more and more as Ishwara, really letting that be and letting the mind enjoy your own, the real source of ananda. Instead of projecting that ananda or wholeness onto an object and then running after and trying to get it, you become much more settled. You become much more settled in your own karma, in your own prarabdha. Actually, your life, you know, the life you've been given, this life, you know, and just having taken a human birth, they say, you know, it's 50% punya, 50% papa. That means that there's hard things in your life, in everybody's life. There's difficult things, and there's pleasurable things, hard circumstances and pleasurable circumstances for everybody. Nobody has an easy go of it, you know. Everybody can, you can think, oh, well, my life is worse than their life is easy. My life is hard. Well, talk to them about it. they're not going to agree with you. Then you can say, well, mine is harder. It's very relative. You know, it's very, very relative. And life isn't easy, but life and its hard, its difficulties lead you toward moksha, really. It leads you toward liberation. Life, with all of its challenges, leads you toward dharma, and it leads you toward moksha, because that's the only way out. The only way out is the recognition of an ananda or a wholeness that you can't change. Right? Because if the ananda or the wholeness is a product of the world, then it is temporary. There's nothing at all that you can do about that, you know. And if it's temporary, the Buddha would say, you know, it's a dukkha yoni. Dukkha yoni means all of your sukha, all of your joy and happiness is just a womb for sorrow. That's all it is. All your sukha, all of your pleasure, it's just a womb for sorrow. You know, if you think that your ananda or fullness is dependent on that experience that by its nature is going to go away.
Well, that's where the irony is, because if I am already, I have well-being, I am complete, and yet the mind always looking for that elsewhere.
No, you know why? Because the mind needs shanti, you know. It needs shanti in order for the vritti, nature of the vritti itself, to feel pleasure. If the mind has agitation, that agitation is what is pain, it's dukkha. Say, we can say the mind is agitated, but that agitation results in dukkha, in sorrow, or different forms of suffering. Mm-hmm. And so the mind's experience of sukha and dukkha depends upon the state of mind, even though the conscious being that you are is absolutely pervasive and present to both. You know, and that your being is competing with pain, you know. And in the shantavritti, it's as though reflecting, it's enjoying your presence in a pleasurable way. what needs to be take place here, though, is that the mind has to discover that the self, the wholeness, not a big sukha-vritti, not these bliss bubbles and things that change. I don't mean that. Those are all mental states. There's sorrowful mental states and joyful mental states. But the mind has to discover the depth of wholeness that is the very nature, right, of yourself, and is present to both the dukkha, the sorrowful vritti, and the pleasurable vritti. And the ananda of that is much deeper and much more profound, to the point that whether you have a pleasurable vritti or a dukkha vritti is inconsequential to the wholeness of your own being. And you, when you recognize, then you can recognize your own wholeness when your mind is throwing up sorrowful vrittis, sorrowful thoughts for you, because there's an emotional lifetime. You still think, oh yeah, well, I want that and I want that, and then you get all engaged in it and all upset about everything. Then you have to pull yourself back because of your knowledge. But there comes a time when you don't do that anymore, or you do it so minimally that it's, you don't even notice it. You just don't do it. You don't do it because why should I? Why should my mind do that when the very source of the fullness is not away from me? It's only because I think it's away from me that I go on behaving like that. And it takes a while to assimilate the truth of it, you know. It's not a matter of a belief or a concept. It's a reality. You know, but that reality has to be recognized over and over again. You know, bring your mind back and you get, that's right. But it's not just a thought, it's a reality. Reality means you're whole. We all know what it is to be whole. It's just it doesn't last. So why doesn't it last? So once you figure out the source, then your mind doesn't feel like really getting all, you know, upset about the world because you didn't work out the way that you wanted. You didn't get this thing that you thought you needed, and that's such a problem. I didn't get what I thought I needed, so then I'm unhappy.
I have a question. So when we feel this wholeness, that, you know, oh, this is who we are, and we're full and complete, at that point, would you still seek to be with a companion, or would you still seek a husband, or would you still seek?
You can't.
When you feel that, you know, you have found that person who's whole and complete, and you know what it takes, then why would we seek outside of ourselves? Or why would we seek a relationship?
It's a different type of seeking. Like, say, for somebody who doesn't have knowledge, there's what I call the desire template, and it goes like this. I want this so that I can be happy. I want this person so that I can be happy. I want this food so that I can be happy. Whatever it is, that's the desire template. For a jnani, for somebody who has self-knowledge, is I want this, but not so that I can be happy. And the reason you want it is because of your prarabdha karma. You know, the karmas, they say the karmas that cause you to take this birth will take you all the way through to your death. And those karmas have to fulfill themselves. When you get knowledge, you're not going to drop dead. The karmas, you know, nobody wants knowledge. Swamiji jokes about that sometimes. He says, who's going to want it? Or who's, raise your hand. Well, as soon as I get knowledge, you'll drop dead. Okay. Everybody will leave the class. Right? I don't want to take that. I don't want to try that. Tomorrow we'll do it. So that means that the karmas are going to go on, take you through your whole life. And what if the prarabdha karma has to do with your being taking sannyasa lifestyle, then you'll do that. If it has to do with being married and having children or whatever it is, those karmas are going to take you through the life. And so what Swamiji said about this, and I notice in my own process of maturing, it becomes just more and more the reality, is that you live your life. It's Ishwara. It's really, the life is, the power of the karma is Ishwara. You live this life and you engage in it and do your best moment to moment. So he says, I do I do the best that I can every moment. He'll have stacks of, he was telling this one time, he has stacks of letters and papers and everything. You never can get down to the bottom of the stack of what needs to be done. Or something like that. You know, so he says, I just do as much as I can to the best of my ability. I mean, that's it. That's the life. And you don't have to be searching for your life. The life, your life is already fully here, moment to moment to moment, with plenty to do, with plenty of things that have to be, you're taken care of and accomplished and enjoyed, and the life is the, that is your life, and you're, it's never, as long as you're alive, it's never away from you, right? It is your life. And so you just do it dharmically to the best of your ability. And then that means that you can be fully engaged, fully related to it. You know, but you're also not asking it to be something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. You can ask it to be something else, but then what are you going to do? You know, like, you can always, and this is what we call karma yoga, too. You can say, but I really want this. And the thing is, if it's in your prarabdha, you will get it. But if it's not in your prarabdha, you won't get it. You know, and so then you have to have an attitude of what we call that prasada buddhi, where I make my efforts to fulfill my desires, you know, as long as they're there, but I take the results as prasad. You know, in the temple, when you take prasad, you don't go, oh no.
So
it's
so
prasad,
this,
you know? Yeah, so you take it as prasad.
So this karma will take care of the life. I don't have to be responsible for shaping it. And
well, you know, that's the truth of it. You don't have to be responsible for shaping it. You know, we think that this is like an inert creation, and then we have to carve out our life, and we have to make it happen.
Yeah.
And in fact, you don't have to make it happen. It is happening. What you have to do is be present to it, you know, to be present to your life. And that doesn't mean that, okay,
I'm going to stay home from now.
Yeah. But, you know, that's actually an act of will. It's not about being lazy or anything like that. It's a trust that you are part of a bigger story, you know, and then to start participating in that story. You know, it's Ishvara. It's all Ishvara. You know, to let yourself participate in the life you've been given. You've been given this life. You know, if you try to jump over into somebody else's life, nothing works. But if you stay within your life, then everything works because it's your life. Your life, the prarabdha karma, is much more than just you taking a birth. This whole thing is part of your prarabdha karma. All the people that are in your life, the situations that you find yourself in, it's like the prarabdha karma surrounds you. It is this body, mind, sense organs, this particular one, your parents, the parents you were born into, the time you were born into, all of these things, but then there's the whole flow of the life that surrounds you, right? It's like the prarabdha is the whole river that you're swimming in, along with you, the one who's swimming in it. See what I mean? The whole situation. And so, and you know, the prarabdha has hard things in it. It has all kinds of things in it, all kinds of situations.
What's the meaning of the word?
Prarabdha, it literally means that which has been begun.
What?
So, that which has begun. And so we say that there are three types of karma for the jiva. The prarabdha is let's do this for the simple, the sanchitta karma. They say you have beginningless lifetimes. So the sanchitta karma are all the karmas that have not yet fructified in a physical, in a given birth. So that's infinite, really. The sanchitta karma in your account is boundless. You know, I don't know if we can say infinite, but it's beginningless, so, you know, it must be infinite. So then out of that sanchita karma comes the prarabdha karma. Right? And so it's like dipping into the sanchita karma and pulling out the prarabdha karma that is actually fructifying through this life. And while that karma, the prarabdha karma, is taking place from birth to death, there's what we call the agami karma. The agami karma are the new karmas that you're accruing. So all of these karmas are really, they're called adrishta karmas. Adrishta means the unseen karmas, where if I divide drishta and adrishta, the seen karmas, the unseen karmas. The seen karmas are those things that are fructifying. I put it like this. I do an action and I immediately get the result. You are getting the karma polas, the results of your actions, as you do a result. But there are adrishta karmas, adrishta the karma polas, to any action. And those are what we call punya and papa. Like, say you do an action, but in the doing of the action, you're committing an adharma. Like Swamiji's used the example of the difference between a thief who takes a knife and cuts somebody and a surgeon who takes a knife and cuts somebody. They're both cutting somebody, but one is a surgeon performing an operation, and the other is a thief who's performing an act of violence. One is, you know, either neutral or gaining punya, and the other is gaining papa. Right? So there's like a moral result. That's what we call punya and papa to any action. And those are the ones that are not fructifying yet necessarily. Those are what are stored in your sanchitta karma. And those karmas will fructify later in another birth. Usually they can sometimes fructify in the same life, but usually it's in another, one of your next births. And that, those next births, say you have an infinite pot of sanchitta karmas, which ones of the sanchitta are you going to use for your next birth will depend upon your agami karmas, the karmas that you're performing in this life. That sets the trajectory for the next life. Just like if you look at this life from birth to death, this action was causal to this effect, to this effect, to this. There's a causal chain, you know, in terms of the results of our actions from birth to death. You can see the relationship. So you would see that continuing when this body drops, that causal chain continues and will attract to itself the sanchitta karmas that are relevant to the trajectory of your life. That's why, and you can't really do much about that trajectory, because your last thought is really, when you leave this body, is really the, in a sense, the cumulative thought of who you are, in terms of a jiva, I mean of a transmigrating the soul, who you are, you know, and that is that's what forms the trajectory of all, that attracts all the karmas for the next life. So it's kind of a ongoing flow. A person who doesn't have this kind of understanding, you'll see this life is from birth to death. But a Hindu is not going to see that like that at all. This is just one. This is just one sequence, you know, of a very, of a infinite chain of experience. You know, and it has a cause-effect relationship. But from our standpoint, as somebody who is embodied right now, the prarabdha karma is birth to death. That's the prarabdha. It's the fructification of those karmas has begun and will end. And when those karmas are exhausted, it'll end. That's the prarabdha karma. It comes from the sanchitta. And then we'll continue to accrue new karmas while we're exhausting this. And that's why all of your experience is going to be a combination of the prarabdha karma and then the free will. So we always get this question, well, what's prarabdha and what's free will and is there free will and all that? Well, there is free will, but it's totally intertwined with the prarabdha karma. You know, within the prarabdha karma, you have free will, but it's not apart from it.
So they really go by that worldview then?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole Judeo-Christian Islam, this biblical world, doesn't have this understanding. We think that they did at one point, maybe around the 3rd century, they did have this type of understanding, but most of the world does have that understanding.
Mm.
They don't look at this as this as just one life. You know, and when you think about it, to have that view that this is just one life, there's no prior karma. It just, this is it. You know, some people have it good and some people have it bad. There's no rhyme or reason for that. But right, and this is it. And you have to get everything you ever want to get done in this life. And so we're very pressured. Yeah. This life isn't long enough. I'd say a Hindu really doesn't have that pressure in the same way. You know, this is my life this time, so let me live it and let me do my best. Let me live it dharmically so that I can get a better life next life. You know, that's also very important. Dharma becomes very important because it will affect my next birth. You know, but there's something relaxing about that. And also, you take responsibility also for this birth in a way that you would not take responsibility at all if there's no prior karma. It's just not fair. That's all.
Yeah.
You know, but for some of you as the more that other type of vision, more of a Hindu vision, let's call it Hindu. You know, I get what I deserve. You know, you don't want to say that about somebody else, but you can say that about yourself. Swamiji's even said that, and I appreciate it. You know, it's like the karmas are infinite, and I'm in this difficult situation, you know, and I have to have something to do with that. I'm not in this difficult situation for no reason. So that helps me actually to.
Because otherwise it looks like arbitrary punishment.
It's arbitrary punishment. Mm-hmm. Arbitrary. You got a raw deal. And there is no reason for it. There's only a cruel God.
Yeah.
There's only a cruel God because there's no karma. You know, there's nothing. Why would this happen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like the book of When Bad Things Happen to Good People. It's the title.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, but is that something that you can actively do to change the everyday?
You can. That's what they call prize chitta karmas.
Your everyday karma, where you change your bank balance for the future.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and also you can mitigate the effects of your karma. That's why they have rituals and pujas and prayers.
Well, you have to go to temple to do that, right? Or can you just do it at home? Or
yeah, you can do it at home. You know. It's hard for us. You can't get to say if we go on and on talking about this, we'll get in trouble. Because the karmas are all so complex, you know. But they have so many stories, you know, about, you know, when we're kind of delving into Maya here, you know, about the efficacy of prayer to neutralize some of those karmas. That's why, you know, you always have your astrology chart done as soon as you're born. They'll look at the whole chart and they'll say, okay, here there's going to be some difficult, we have to do these prayers and rituals at this time. And the parents will know for the whole, their child, their whole life, these are the parts, you know, where we have to do some prayers and rituals and prayaschitta karmas and things in order to try to neutralize or mitigate the effects, you know. So.
Is Vedic astrology, is that pretty different?
You know, it seems to, I don't know enough about it, but it seems to be something, I mean, it's so integrated. Well, it's so integrated into the culture. Even Swamiji will look at people's charts. You know, when I took my, whenever I take my niece or nephew or anybody to meet Swamiji, I always take their chart. And he'll say, if I don't take the chart, he'll say, get me their chart. And I will always, I always do that. Even if any students or anything, I always make sure they get their chart taken. He'll look at it and, you know, and he sees a lot in there, you know.
And then he's looking at the Jupiter. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah, he'll be look. Well, he'll look at so many different things. Mm-hmm. You know?
Is there someone you know around here that does those charts?
We should ask Tara or Virginia or Penny Farrell. They know. They can either do it themselves. Or
I thought you could go online and punch it in and it comes out.
No, that's all. There are some really good softwares that do it too.
But the softwares, anybody, they, even astrologers use the software. Why not? Because it's all mathematical. But then to really understand what a chart is saying requires a lot of knowledge and a lot of skill. I'm out of my element talk. I'm just talking about it.
We bypass all that anyhow, don't we, with this Vedanta?
You know, you can't say that you bypass. Bypass is a bad word. There's no bypassing, you know, but you don't need to use astrology.
You use Rudra, right?
Yeah. But astrology is very integrated into the Indian culture. You know, it's part of the culture. You know, I wouldn't start something new without, you know, a new beginning. You want to start it at an auspicious time. Why not? You know? So... anyway, where am I?
Something that they've been doing for so long.
For so long.
Yeah.
People are getting married all over the world and their marriages are very successful and they didn't plan it. It just happened at the right moment.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah. I told them to change the marrying on Saturdays.
On a certain day and time, when the moon is somewhere. And
They changed. They never did that.
Let's call it a night.